From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care for me.
The Smithsonian Institution has a new exhibition called Ella Fitzgerald, First Lady of Song. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Ella Fitzgerald's biographer, Stuart Nicholson. We'll hear how she changed from a would-be dancer to a singer and how she was transformed from an unkempt, virtually homeless teenager into a sophisticated interpreter of popular song. And, of course, we'll play some of her greatest recordings. Also, film critic John Powers reviews two acclaimed foreign films that are beginning to show in the U.S., A Taste of Cherry from Iran and Fireworks from Japan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Two of the five people killed in a shooting at a local school in Jonesboro, Arkansas, are being buried today. The victims were gunned down by two young boys on Tuesday. NPR's Adam Hochberg is in Jonesboro and filed this report.
A private family service now is underway at the Farmers Union Funeral Home in Jonesboro. Inside, family members and friends are remembering Paige Ann Herring, who was killed Tuesday, less than 2 weeks after her 12th birthday. Herring was one of four young girls killed in the ambush shooting spree. One teacher died and 10 students were wounded. There are no classes today at Westside Middle School where the shooting took place. The day had long been designated as a teacher work day. Many of the mourners who came to the funeral this morning were Paige's classmates and members of the school basketball team on which she played. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Jonesboro, Arkansas.
The Marine Corps says formal charges have been filed against four crew members whose plane severed a ski cable at an Italian ski resort last month. 20 people were killed. The four Marines face a variety of charges, including involuntary manslaughter and negligent homicide. A military review had concluded they were flying too fast and too low when the incident occurred. President Clinton is due at a state dinner in South Africa this hour. Earlier today, he toured the prison where thousands of political prisoners were held during apartheid. South African President Nelson Mandela was one of them. He walked with President Clinton to visit the cell where he was held for 18 years. The visit followed a joint news conference by the two leaders. Mandela praised President Clinton's international instincts, but he defended his loyalties to Iran, Cuba, and Libya, who supported him in his battles against the apartheid government.
Our moral authority dictates that we should not abandon those who helped us in the darkest hour in the history of this country.
For his part, President Clinton praised the new South African government, saying it has come a long way.
It is in our profound interest to support the positive changes in Africa's life. Nowhere is this more evident than in the miracle you have wrought here in South Africa. The partnership between our nations is only 4 years old, but already we are laying the foundation for a greater future.
Mr. Clinton is the first U.S. president to visit South Africa. Russian President Boris Yeltsin says he wants the man he has named as acting prime minister to have the job on a permanent basis, and he's asked the Russian parliament to confirm Sergei Kiryenko to replace Viktor Chernomyrdin. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 38.5 points at this hour. It stands at 88.08. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the French, British, Spanish, and German companies that manufacture the Airbus aircraft have agreed in principle on a merger that would create a single European aerospace and defense company. That move would create a European company able to compete with the likes of U.S. giants Boeing and Lockheed Martin. The plans also involve expanding the focus from civilian aircraft to military planes. The stock market is lower this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down for a third straight session. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
Stock market is being pressured by rising long-term interest rates, which are up on the view that a Fed tightening appears inevitable. Computer software issues are lower after Adobe Systems reported a 50% drop in first quarter earnings, which was much worse than expected. There is also weakness in diversified healthcare issues, along with regional telephone and international oil stocks. On an otherwise down day, McDonald's is up nearly 4% after Salomon Smith Barney and Bear Stearns rated the stock a buy. I'm Doug Krisner.
Americans' incomes rose 0.6% in February, while spending increased 0.4%. That word from the Commerce Department this morning. Increasing income growth in recent months reflects the tight job market, and spending has been spurred by low interest rates and consumer confidence. The bidding war for Rolls-Royce motor cars continues. Germany's BMW announced it has submitted a bid to counter that of rival Volkswagen. BMW says it's wanted to get into the luxury car business for a long time. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Smithsonian has a new exhibition called Ella Fitzgerald, First Lady of Song. It includes costumes, awards, photos, recordings, sheet music, and personal memorabilia. On this archive edition, we're going to look back on Ella Fitzgerald's life and music. We have an interview with Stuart Nicholson, author of a 1993 biography of her. He's also the author of a book about Billie Holiday. Our interview was recorded shortly after Ella Fitzgerald's death at the age of 79 in June of 1996. Perhaps her greatest recorded legacy is her songbook series, which collected her renditions of songs by some of America's greatest composers, including Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, Irving Berlin, and Duke Ellington. This is from her Gershwin songbook.
How glad the many millions of Timothys and Williams would be to capture me. But you had such persistence, you wore down my resistance. I fell, and it was swell. You're my big and brave and handsome Romeo. How I won you, I shall never, never know. It's not that you're attractive, but oh, my heart grew active when you came into view. I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie, all the day and night time. Hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall with so much emotion. Could you coo? Could you care? For a cunning cottage, we could share. The world will pardon my mush, 'cause I've got a crush, my baby, on you.
I asked Stuart Nicholson how he came to write a biography of Ella Fitzgerald.
I wrote a book called Jazz, the 1980s Resurgence, and in that I did a chapter on singers, and a firm of publishers in this country approached me to see if I'd like to do a biography on Ella to celebrate her 75th year, which was upcoming at the time. But the more that I kind of dug into Ella Fitzgerald, the more that I realised that really no one really knew an awful lot about Ella. It was really the product of her press office. Ella wasn't really interested in giving interviews, and she was offhand and gave simple, straightforward answers. Sometimes she would answer questions with just one word, you know, and it was left then for the journalist to fill in the blanks. And I think if you transpose this over a whole lifetime of evasion, if you like, so to paraphrase the man who shot Liberty Valance, When Ella became a legend, they printed the legend, and that has really stuck through her lifetime. And now, when I sat down to do do the biography, I was just astounded how little had been unearthed. And really what I did was put all previous research aside and start again from scratch.
Did you ever get a personal interview with her?
No. Very few people did, and certainly not in her later life. But I was very fortunate because when the book was upcoming for American publication, Norman Granz contacted me and was very kind in helping me rejig the book for American publication. And so he spent a lot of time with me going over stuff and giving it a different spin. So I think the English version greatly benefited from his input. And of course, as you'll recall from reading it yourself, I tried to home in on key musicians who knew Ella right the way through her career. I tracked down members of the original Chick Webb band, musicians who she played with during the 1940s, 1950s, and so on, and really got a perspective of Ella. You know, from the bandstand, from the people really who she was closest to, because really she was always close to musicians rather than people.
Stuart Nicholson is my guest, and he's written a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. Tell us about the circumstances of her birth, when she was born, where, who her parents were.
Well, Ella was born in Newport News, Virginia, on the 25th of April, 1917. Her father was William Fitzgerald, and her mother was formerly Temperance Williams, Temperance Fitzgerald, and she was known as Tempy. And it seems that William and Tempy split up fairly shortly after Ella was born, and Tempy made her way to New York, which was you know, the streets were paved with gold and greater employment prospects there and so forth. And She shows up, first of all, in New York at 72 School Street in Yonkers. And what I discovered was that no one really had ever traced her family friends, school friends, so we didn't have a perspective of Ella's early life. And so with the help of Marcia Dennis, we put an advert in the local Yonkers press. And three people actually responded, and we cross-checked their names on census for the appropriate years, and it was they all cross-checked, so we knew that these people were quite genuine. And the surprising thing about speaking to people who knew Ella as a child is they've been waiting all this time for someone to contact them, you know, and it was kind of like, well, so here you are at last, you know, and they were so kind in giving me a perspective of Ella as a child, and that perspective was one of a kid who was really wanting to do better for herself, but she wanted to do it as a dancer and not as a singer.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, and it gives you a sense of how early she must have had that wonderful sense of rhythm, but she was expressing it with her body and not her voice.
That's absolutely right. Yes.
Which is also interesting, considering her body blew up so much as a more mature woman. She must have had a very different kind of body as a young girl.
Apparently, she was as skinny as a rake, and of course, the one thing that came across was that she was living in quite desperate poverty, mm-hmm. and. Her friend at that particular time was a guy called Charles Miller, who and he was dancing mad, and he and Ella used to sneak into Harlem to pick up the latest steps, dance steps, and they used to go in do little one-night stands in local talent shows in and around Yonkers, you know, Elks clubs, things, and pick up a few dollars here just for dancing with you know, the trio or quartet or something like that.
Now, we should mention here that Ella Fitzgerald's mother died in 1932 at the age of 38 of a heart attack, and Ella Fitzgerald left her stepfather, who you think may have been abusing her, and joined her Aunt Virginia and the family in Harlem.
Well, the interesting thing there is that each person who knew her said that suddenly she was gone. Her aunt just came and took her, and certainly Charles Miller said her father, a guy called De Silva, was abusing her. He wasn't letting her out, and this sort of thing. And it's significant that in later in life, in 1977, Ella formed a child care center in the Linwood section of Watts. And her principal concern with that child center was for abused children.
No, Ella Fitzgerald's aunt was a numbers runner, And Ella Fitzgerald brought in some extra money by what, being a lookout at a whorehouse?
That's right. That's right. And the striking thing is here that how similar in many respects Billie Holiday's early years were, and how similar Ella Fitzgerald's was, and we always tend to think of Ella as the Puritan and Billie who led life to the full, but their early lives were kind of, you know, very, very similar. Certainly, Billie Holiday was raped as a child, and for the first time I named the rapist from the files in Baltimore, from the trial files. And certainly here we have Ella with a very strong possibility of being abused as a child and living life around a whorehouse, keeping cave, you know, for police coming. Similar with Billie Holiday, she used to earn money cleaning rooms in a whorehouse. So both had terribly deprived backgrounds and yet led completely different lifestyles.
Ella Fitzgerald ran away from home and from school when she was... a young teenager. Where did she run away from?
Well, who knows, really? She went into a home on the Hudson River.
This was after staying with her aunt.
Yes, that's right. She had behavioral problems, and she was put into a home. But certainly, it was from the home that for Negro children that she ran away from, and she certainly didn't like it. And it's interesting that this particular home had benefit concerts given for it by Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, lots of name performers. But Ella Fitzgerald never gave one concert for it. Whether she was approached, we'll never know. But it's significant that she must have really hated that place. And by the time she was discovered in 1935, she was actually living on the streets, according to Charles Linton, the vocalist with the Chick Webb Band.
And he's the person who actually discovered her and convinced Chick Webb to hire her as the singer. So what were the conditions of her life at that time? She was nearly homeless,
She was homeless. She was living life on the street, and she was unwashed. She had men's shoes on, and she was a bit of a spectacle. Chick Webb recoiled in horror when he saw what he was confronted with, as did lots of guys in the band who started teasing Ella initially. But she quickly got into shape and fell into line and realized what an opportunity she had, and she took it with both hands.
How did Charles Linton, the singer from the Chick Webb Band, discover Ella Fitzgerald?
Well, Chick Webb was banned. Was kind of in the doldrums. Chick Webb was a very, very, very keen to a very ambitious band leader, and he could see that Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway were earning far more than he was, and the manager Mo Gale convinced him that really he ought to get a girl vocalist that might be the link between the bandstand, because of course Chick was a dwarfish figure, and he had a terrible hunched back, and really not the kind of guy which would sort of be a link between the bandstand and the audience. It was thought really that a girl singer might do the trick, quite simply Charles Linton started asking around. He was a very good looking man, a ladies' man, and he was thought to be the guy perhaps to find a girl singer, and that's what he did. A friend of his said, you know, why don't you try Ella? She's just won the talent contest at the Harlem Apollo, which she did on the 21st of November, 1934. Incidentally, a week after Billie Holiday made her debut at the Apollo. Already their careers are interlinking.
Now, just an interesting sidebar here that you mentioned in your biography of Ella Fitzgerald. When she performed at the Apollo amateur night, she intended to dance, but she thought the competition would be too stiff, and that's why she sang instead.
Well, that's right. The Wednesday before the Friday night talent contest, there was a run-through, and she realized the competition that she was up against, and she realized that her personal appearance really was not going to compete with girls in sequin gowns and dancing pumps. And it was at that point, it wasn't before she actually went on the stage, it was at that point that she decided that she would sing a song.
Stuart Nicholson is my guest, and he's written a biography of Ella Fitzgerald, which is now out in paperback. We'll talk more about her life and hear more of her music after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stuart Nicholson, author of a 1993 biography of Ella Fitzgerald. Now let's get back to Ella Fitzgerald's story with the Chick Webb Band. So the Chick Webb Band hired her when she was homeless, unwashed. The musicians complained that she smelled. How did they transform her into, a singer who's going to be on stage and, you know, be like attractive and well dressed?
Well, one of the band members took Ella under her wing. Charles Linton was paid for a room for her, and gradually she realized that what an opportunity that she had presented to her, and people in the Savoy Ballroom kind of rallied round. The woman who was on the ladies' room sort of took her aside, and it was everyone sort of rallied round and tried to help her as best they could, and Ella took the opportunity, and within weeks of trying out at the Savoy Ballroom, she was in the recording studio making a recording debut with very little previous experience, whereas Billie Holiday had been doing the clubs, the nightclubs, and working, really started at the bottom and gradually worked her way up around the bar and grill circuits in Harlem. Ella kind of stepped, from nowhere into the big time in one step. I mean, she did one or two amateur hour contests in the Harlem Opera House and the Harlem Apollo, but that's about all. She sang a couple of times with a band leader, but this really didn't amount to the depth of experience that Billie Holiday was getting. It was just that she did it on talent alone.
One of the recordings that really put Ella Fitzgerald on the map was a Tisket a Tasket. Tell us the story behind how this was recorded.
Well, that was a million seller, of course, Ella had the idea come to her when the band was playing in Boston, and a guy called Van Alexander was doing a lot of arranging for Chick Webb at that particular time, and Ella kind of said, "Well, I've got this idea of a song. Here's the song. Sang it. They worked it out at the piano. Worked out the chords." And Van Alexander said, "Yes, well, I'll do something." And Ella, about a couple of weeks later, kept pushing him. Eventually, he came up with an arrangement. Chick Webb liked it, and it's significant that when Ella got into the Chick Webb Band, really she became the focal point of the Chick Webb Band on broadcasts. Chick Webb played less instrumentals; it was more featuring Ella, perhaps featuring Charles Linton in the early stages. So he listened to what Ella said, and Deckard really didn't want to record it. They thought it was too silly, and Chick Webb forced the issue. He said, "Well, if you're not going to record it, we'll pack up the band and leave." And the recording engineer acquiesced, and the rest is history.
Well, why don't we hear a Tisket a Tasket, Ella Fitzgerald and the Chick Webb Orchestra.
A tisket a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mummy. On the way I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it, a little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking on down the avenue, but not a single thing to do. She went peck, peck, pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, my little yellow basket. And if she doesn't bring it back, I think that I will die.
It's Ella Fitzgerald, and my guest is Stuart Nicholson, the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. Ella Fitzgerald, early in her career, recorded a lot of novelty tunes and a lot of very light pop tunes. How did she end up going so much in that direction earlier in her career?
Well, she was making the most of an opportunity that was given to her, and it was during the time that she was with Chick Webb that she became known as the first lady of song, simply because Chick Webb had quite a bit of airtime in those
on the radio
years. Oh, that's right, yes, which was unusual. He had more airtime than practically any band at that particular time in America. So music publishers were hanging around him like flies, and Ella had a first crack at practically any tune that was upcoming from the music publishing houses, and that was how the name the First Lady of Song came about, because she was the first in with her version of lots and lots of songs which were broadcast, which is more it was more important then to broadcast songs than it was to have hit records at that particular time.
And the publishers wanted Ella Fitzgerald to sing the song because they thought it would help sell the song.
That's right, and unlike Billie Holiday, for example, who would improvise with a song, distort the original melody line to her own particular requirements. Ella sang it straight, and really she was a music publisher's dream, because you got the perfect version in one hit of a song with Ella.
But unfortunately, early in her career, a lot of the songs she did were really lightweight, trivial songs.
Well, one of the things I say in the book is that really you could not say that Ella Fitzgerald was a jazz singer during that period, and certainly not until really, I guess, during the early 1940s, when she started getting interested in bebop. And she was singing Flying Home as early as 1942 with bebop inflections, and this was made very clear by a couple of reviews which I unearthed, which surprised me. But mind you, bebop had been fermenting, perhaps a year, 2 years beforehand, and it was really only because of the AFM strike that it suddenly seemed to burst on the world, fully formed in 1945. But lots of musicians were experimenting with extended changes, with new rhythmic nuance. And Ella was up there in Harlem. She was listening, and she was fascinated by the latest musical trend.
Stuart Nicholson is the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. We'll hear more from Nicholson in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more music by Ella Fitzgerald as we continue our discussion with her biographer, Stuart Nicholson, and film critic John Powers reviews two acclaimed foreign films.
Whenever skies look gray to me, and trouble begins to brew, whenever the winter winds become too strong, I concentrate on you. When fortune cries nay, nay to me, and people declare you're through, whenever
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1996 interview with British writer Stuart Nicholson, author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. The occasion for this rebroadcast is a new exhibition at the Smithsonian Institution called Ella Fitzgerald, First Lady of Song. One of the things Ella Fitzgerald became very known for was her scatting. And one of the earlier examples on that is her 1947 recording of Lady Be Good, which we're going to hear in a moment. But tell us what you know about how she started scatting.
Well, I think scatting was her way of getting closer to what the big band musicians, Taft Jordan and people like that around her were playing, and it's a natural thing for a singer to imitate instrumental voices around her, and she'd been singing from an early age, surrounded by some of the greatest musicians of the swing era, and it's only natural that she should want to emulate them, and Leo Watson really was very popular at that time, a crazy scat singer who. Take a program on its own to talk about Leo Watson, a much neglected figure in jazz. And Ella took a little bit of Leo Watson and took a little bit of what she was hearing around her in the bebop of bebop and came up with her own version of it.
Let's hear her 1947 recording of Lady Be Good with the Bob Haggart Orchestra. What is so special about this recording in her career?
Well, this was the time when Ella really came into her own right as a jazz singer and a jazz singer in capital letters. The arrangement behind her is kind of old hat and had swing-era musicians, but Ella soars above that, and here we have the blossoming of one of the great 20th-century music talents.
This is Ella Fitzgerald, recorded in 1947.
Sweet and lovely, lady be good, oh lady be good to me, 'cause I'm so awfully misunderstood. Oh lady, be good to me. Say I'm all alone in this big city of New York. Won't somebody please have pity, 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 pity on me. Just a lonesome babe, babe in the woods. Oh lady, oh lady, oh lady, be good to me.
That's Ella Fitzgerald. My guest is Stuart Nicholson, who's the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. When Ella Fitzgerald started recording the Chick Webb, she was best known for her novelty songs. Of course, what we remember her for best now is her songbooks and her beautiful renderings of classic American popular song. Let's talk a little bit about her transition into that form of American popular song. And this happens in the early 1950s with a series of recordings she made with the fine pianist Ellis Larkins. What was behind those recordings?
Well, her record producer at that time was a guy called Milt Gabler at Decca Records. And he had just released a composite album of artists, each doing a song from the then very popular South Pacific. And it occurred to Gabler that he might do just an album by Ella, concentrating on the songs of George Gershwin, just as an experiment. And the very sophisticated pianist Ellis Larkins was chosen. And here we have Ella exploring the songs with the freedom to do whatever really she wanted to. The only limit was her imagination.
And she did two sets of sessions with Ellis Larkins. One was all Gershwin songs and the other was a mix of songs.
That's right.
Let's hear her 1954 recording with him of Until the Real Thing Comes Along.
I'd work for you, I'd slave for you, I'd be a beggar or a knave for you. If that isn't love, it will have to do. Until the real thing
gently move the earth for you to prove my love, dear, and its worth for you. If that isn't love, it will have to do until the real thing comes along. With all the words, dear, at my command, I just can't make you understand. I'll always love you, darling, come what may. My heart is yours. What more can I say? I'd sigh for you, I'd cry for you, I'd tear the stars down from the sky for you. If that isn't love, well, if that isn't love, it will have to do until the real thing comes along, until the
Ella Fitzgerald and pianist Ellis Larkins. We'll talk more with Ella Fitzgerald's biographer Stuart Nicholson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stuart Nicholson, author of a 1993 biography of Ella Fitzgerald.
Many of the records that really define Ella Fitzgerald and define a certain kind of singing are her recordings on Verve Records, the Songbook Records, for example. Those records were produced by Norman Granz. How did Norman Granz decide to record Ella in the songbook settings? Ella Fitzgerald sings Cole Porter, George Gershwin, Riders on Heart.
Well, he'd already done this with Oscar Peterson on one of his subsidiary labels a few years before. Oscar Peterson had recorded, I think, about five or six albums of the great Broadway composers and one by Duke Ellington. So the idea was at the forefront of his mind. And really what he did was take it stage further and get a big studio orchestra to back her up. And really the first one of these was the Cole Porter Songbook, which was released, the first one of the Songbook series. And really what we have here is part jazz leader and part cocktail music. It was really middle-of-the-road music, meant for middle-of-the-road America. So, sort of music that doesn't get in the way of conversations. It was a kind of the New Age music of its time.
Let's listen to a track from her Gershwin songbook. I thought we could play The Man I Love. I think the Gershwin songbook is one of your favorites of the songbook series.
Absolutely, yes. Arrangements here by Nelson Riddle. It was the first time that Norman Granz, who actually wanted Nelson Riddle for the Cole Porter songbook, but he finally was able to get Nelson Riddle, who was doing great work with Frank Sinatra at this particular time, and that was one of the reasons why Norman Granz wanted him to act as direct competition to Frank Sinatra and his great work on Capitol.
This is Ella Fitzgerald.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love, and when he comes
comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and smile, I'll understand, and in a little while he'll take my hand. And though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say a word. Maybe I shall meet him Sunday, maybe Monday, maybe not. Still, I'm sure to meet him one day, maybe Tuesday will be my good news. Just meant for two, from which I'll never roam. Who would you? And so all else above, I'm waiting for the man I love.
That's Ella Fitzgerald, and my guest Stuart Nicholson is the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. You know, I love her songbook records, and I found it interesting reading in your book that so many of the songbook recordings were made really quickly, one take on a lot of the records, and some of the musicians you interviewed referred to these songs as being kind of ground out. You say she even just, like, learned some of the songs for the session.
Sometimes, actually, on the session, which is some of the more obscure, not everyday songs from the Broadway canon, were actually learnt on the session. She would run through it, but this goes back to her days as a popular music singer for Decca. Again, during her Decca years, she would not know what she would be called to a recording session. She would not know what she was going to be confronted with. And this is the way she made her living, you know, or at least her recording income. It's just by singing songs that were given to her on the session. And it's quite phenomenal that musicians who I interviewed in the book say that, you know, she'd just hear the song once or twice. She would go through it once and sing it, and it would be a take virtually on, you know. And if you look through her discography, you know, she very seldom goes into two and three takes, you know, during her Decca years. It's probably first or second take. And really, this was a continuation of the great professionalism which she had built up over the years. And so she was really, in a sense, it seems extraordinary to us what she was achieving, but in fact, it was really a continuation of the craft that she had learned through the years, through the 1940s and here into the 1950s.
Now, I know one of your favorite recordings of Ella Fitzgerald is her 1958 concert in Rome, which was only released on record in 1987 after it was discovered in the Verve vaults.
That's right, by Phil Schapper, a great, great jazz aficionado and fan.
And radio DJ in New York.
That's right.
Tell me what you love about this particular concert.
Well, I think the whole essence of Ella Fitzgerald is the one place in the world that she really wanted to be is on stage singing. And really, she dedicated her whole life to this. I mean, everything went by the board, a stable family life, friends, she made very few friends because she was on the road touring throughout her life. And even when she could have retired in Beverly Hills luxury in the 1960s, and don't forget she was a millionairess then, she really wanted to be on the road singing. And this is where the real Ella Fitzgerald, the exuberance, just the sheer joy of music making comes out. And I think really this is really the real Ella Fitzgerald, because really that's what Ella wanted herself. And she was very much an in-person artist.
I thought I'd play Squeeze Me from that concert. This is not a song I usually love, but her recording of it, as you say, it just has such exuberance. She's snapping her fingers. There's this kind of uninhibited feeling on this and a beautiful sense of rhythm. I just think this just, like, absolutely jumps out of the turntable or the CD player. It's I love it. Do you want to say anything about this?
Well, I think you've said it all, Terry. This is Ella Fitzgerald performing in front of people. It was one of the great experiences in jazz and popular music in the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s. She was a true performance artist.
Ella Fitzgerald recorded in Rome in 1958. This is Squeeze Me.
I want you to know I ain't for no teasing. Want you to know I go for your squeezing. Want you to know I'm aiming to pleasing. Babble doo boo doo dee 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 dee. Treat me sweet and gentle. When you hold me tight, just squeeze me. But please don't tease me. I get sentimental when you hold me tight. Just squeeze me. But please don't tease me. Missing you since you went away. Thinking about you through the day. Hoping and longing for you. I'm in a mood to let you know I love you so. Please say you love me too.
It's Ella Fitzgerald. My guest, Stuart Nicholson, is the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald. Hearing Ella Fitzgerald on the wonderful song we just heard, her performance of Squeeze Me, and how just free and uninhibited she sounds, it's interesting to think about how much performance anxiety she suffered, which you write about in your biography. How much of a problem was that for her?
Well, it's always been a great mystery to me. Someone who seemed to be so wonderfully relaxed, so exuberant on stage,
living in song.
That's right. She'd be so tormented by it. But the fact nevertheless remains that before a performance, people say that she would be very snappy, very uptight before she went on, and people didn't dare address her, even speak to her, because they would get their heads bitten off. And as soon as she walked on stage, everything, you know, and particularly in her later years, people say that, you know, here was this woman, you know, in her late 60s, she may have been knitting before she went on stage, and she looked, you know, like a shriveled little old lady. But suddenly, as soon as she put her foot on the boards, the years would shed away, and suddenly, you know, she would look 20 to 30 years younger in attitude and exuberance and energy. This was just what Ella wanted to do all her life, is just sing for her people, as she put it.
You write about Ella Fitzgerald as being very lonely for much of her life.
Well, yes, I think we touched upon that very briefly earlier when I said that, you know, that because she wanted to sing, because of this consuming desire to perform in front of live audiences. And don't forget, as I said earlier, that you know, she could have retired in Beverly Hills luxury in the 1960s, but she didn't. That, I think that says a lot about Ella's desire to perform, which was there throughout her life. And it meant really that relationships came second. She was married twice, once in 1941 to a guy called Benny Cornegay, and again in 1947, on the 10th of December 1947, she married the bassist Ray Brown. But these marriages never lasted, and the reason was that being leading a musician's life, a relationship becomes that of, you know, ships passing in the night. And in the 50s and in the 60s, Ella's life was really a matter of, you know, sort of some very discreet affairs with various you know, people who she became friendly with, but none of them ever really got anywhere. And really, she, in a sense, she perhaps preferred her own company. And Lou Levy speaks of Ella being a great fan of soap operas and really, you know, a great television fan, and a very close friend of Peggy Lee's, whom she used to you know, confide in regularly.
Stuart Nicholson, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of what you've learned about Ella Fitzgerald's life. It's a pleasure to have had you on the show.
Thank you indeed.
Stuart Nicholson is the author of a biography of Ella Fitzgerald, published in paperback by DiCapo. Our interview was recorded in June 1996, shortly after Ella Fitzgerald's death at the age of 79. The Smithsonian has a new exhibition called Ella Fitzgerald, First Lady of Song. Stuart Nicholson has a new book coming out in June called Jazz Rock, A History. Coming up, John Powers reviews two foreign films that have just come to the U.S. This is Fresh Air. Two of the most acclaimed foreign films of the past year are just beginning to play in American theaters. A Taste of Cherry from Iran was last year's winner at Cannes, and the Japanese film Fireworks took the top prize at the Venice Film Festival. John Powers has a review of both films.
Although American movies are filled with people dying, 1,500 on the Titanic alone, they're seldom about death. Foreign filmmakers are less afraid of this most dauntingly universal of topics. And in fact, the two best movies I've seen in the last year both deal with the face-off between life and mortality. In one, the hero struggles against death. In the other, he longs to embrace it. Fireworks is the latest movie by Takeshi Kitano, the comedian, columnist, TV MC, filmmaker, and movie actor who's a Japanese superstar. Imagine Clint Eastwood and David Letterman rolled into one. Although Kitano's a cult figure in Europe, his movies are almost completely unknown in the States. Fireworks should change all that, for this movie showcases his greatest gifts: a supremely modern sense of time and mood, a visual style as majestically spare as a Basho haiku, and a screen persona riveting in its silence. Kitano's stony face suggests an entire universe of feelings: melancholy, peasant humor, shameless sentimentality, and a chilling capacity for violence. In Fireworks, he plays Nishi, a taciturn police detective whose world starts to crumble. His daughter has just died, his wife has a terminal illness, and his sidekicks have been caught in a shootout that left one of them dead, the other in a wheelchair. In order to discharge his responsibilities as a man, Nishi quits the police force and tries to take care of everyone, supporting the dead cop's wife, giving his crippled friend oil paints to distract him from thoughts of suicide, and taking his wife on a second honeymoon that's heartbreaking in its sweetness. This terribly silent man must learn to show his wife that he loves her. The original Japanese title of this film, Hana Bi, can be broken into two component words. Hana, meaning flower, which is a metaphor for life and growth, and bi, meaning fire, a metaphor for destruction. It's precisely the inescapable conflict between destruction and life that gives this movie its mystery and emotional power. Nishi does everything he can to protect those he cares about. But can we ever really save anyone from loss or pain or the inexorable working of time? One of the great 90s films, Fireworks is an elliptical meditation on life's struggle against death. And to tell you the whole truth, it left me in tears. I was moved in a very different way by A Taste of Cherry, the latest masterpiece from Abbas Kiarostami, the Iranian director who's probably the most important filmmaker now working anywhere. Kiarostami does all the things that our much-vaunted American independent should do, but never even seem to try. He uses small budgets to explore enormous themes. He takes stories from daily life and wins wonderful performances from amateur actors. And he shoots in a style as transparent as a brand new window pane. Never showy, but immaculately clear. A Taste of Cherry begins with its hero driving through the dusty outskirts of Tehran, looking for a man to help him with the task. From the initial reactions, we wonder if he's asking for sex. But eventually we discover that the truth's far darker. He's contemplating suicide, and he's searching for someone who will bury him if he succeeds, or rescue him if he fails. In his search, he meets various ordinary Iranians, a laborer, a soldier, a security guard, a seminarian, and finally an assistant taxidermist. All are decent, well-meaning men who argue against the man's desire to kill himself. In a way, A Taste of Cherry could also be called Hana Bi. For like Kitano's film, it's about the flower of life and the fire of destruction. Even as it treats suicide as a valid response to the world, in daring violation of Islamic doctrine, it makes an equally strong case for the glory of life. In fact, despite its grim theme, the movie features some wonderful bits of comedy and a lovely speech by the taxidermist, who explains why it's worth living for the taste of cherries alone. From beginning to end, the movie's suffused with the reverence for life that has become this filmmaker's trademark. Abbas Kiarostami looks at human beings with a gaze so tender that it makes your soul tremble, then soar.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Scott Derechinsky. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeremy Irons talks with us about his movies, including The French Lieutenant's Woman, Reversal of Fortune, Dead Ringers, and the controversial not-yet-released adaptation of Lolita. He's currently starring in The Man in the Iron Mask, and his movie Chinese Box opens soon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.